Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, mostly on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Ladles and jelly spoons, boys and girls, welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. This is your host, Michael Veazey. Welcome to 2020. If you're listening fresh, if you're halfway through 2020, then this should be evergreen stuff, aiming to create content that is going to be valuable down the line when things have changed in the TOS and everything else. Particularly think this is going to be evergreen stuff because we're actually bringing somebody for outside the Amazon bubble. Shock horror. Bringing in Davis Wynn of myconsultingoffer.org. And I asked Davis what his tagline was for himself and his business. He said he simply takes online businesses to seven figures within a year, which is quite the claim. So let's get to it. Davis, welcome to the show.
Michael, thanks for having me.
And where are you calling into us from today?
Well, I split my time, but today I'm in Southeast Asia, Thailand to be exact. But I split my time between Thailand and, well, I guess a couple of places, but San Francisco is probably based when I'm not in Asia.
Excellent. So yeah, I remember last time we spoke, you were in San Francisco. So quite the international perspective you've got going there as well, which I think is very, very helpful these days. So let's, first of all, let's talk about that tagline. It takes online businesses to seven figures within a year. So that's quite the claim. I know that so far it's been mostly coaching and info product type businesses, but stay tuned if you're an e-commerce seller, which I presume you are, if you're in that target audience, because I think there's an awful lot. There's a reason why we brought Davis on then, that getting that bigger picture thinking that is going to directly help you in 2020. So first of all, tell me a bit about this, taking online businesses to seven figures within a year.
Sure, absolutely. So it started with my current business right now, my consulting offer. But a little background is that I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur. So my parents, they're both. So if anyone's ever curious about pronouncing my last name, it's of Vietnamese origin. And so my parents, they're political refugees from Vietnam. So growing up, my grandma owned a nail salon in our neighborhood. And I was always inspired by her, as in she took the money that she saved up working at Delta Airlines, basically baggage, and converting it into a store. So, but of course, my grandma had a physical store that she had to man. And of course, comes with it two things. One is she's pretty much opening a shop and closing it for many years. And second, the lesson I learned is this, the lesson of perseverance. As in, I love my grandma and everything that she did. But for example, we were in a low-income neighborhood, so we grew up pretty poor. And she was robbed multiple times. We even had an arson burn the store down, as in there were so many robberies and so forth. And the police, I think, got tired of coming down to my grandma's shop, but it really taught me the value of perseverance. And then, of course, when it came to me to start a business, I kind of wanted a business that, one, would be able to work from anywhere, as in, you say San Francisco and Thailand, I think let's avoid winter. So that is the location choice there. But in terms of taking a business, it's pretty much my current business right now, my consulting offer, started as a side hustle when I was working at another company, which we also took from six figures to eight figures on that one. But that's pretty much the history of it, was just figuring out how do we make something that people love, and then naturally it just grows them. So when I make that claim, it's more about figuring out how do we make something that people love and rave about. And of course, the growth comes naturally afterwards.
Okay. Wow. I mean, first of all, hats off to your grandmother. I mean, that's like the classic Vietnamese American story, really, isn't it? I've heard of a few Vietnamese Americans that were incredible entrepreneurs, partly because they were just, they took hits that most people would think of as just devastating, and they just kind of dealt with it, which is amazing. So hats off to your grandmother and or her memory. But also that's an extraordinary, start. You were working for one business, went for six to seven figures, and while as a side hustle also went there. So congratulations, that's pretty amazing. So obviously you've gone from the idea of the physical store from your grandmother's day to the idea of the location independence that comes from more of an online-based business, which I guess a lot of people who are starting off Amazon businesses are motivated by. And it is true, by the way. I had one member of the 10K Collective Mastermind who left, not because she wasn't happy with the group, but simply was too successful at living all over the world. So that does happen. Yeah, physical products, is that something you've done much? You've mentioned that you've done consulting type business yourself and you've helped consulting businesses. Is there any physical products in the mix there in your background?
So there are people obviously who come to me and they have physical products and I help them with a high level strategy. But in terms of, for me personally, physical products is something I'll probably explore in the future. But for now, I love the one-on-one interaction, as in it doesn't scale as much as, for example, just scaling up production in San Diego for factories or in Shenzhen. But of course, I really love it. So short answer right now is no physical products currently, unless you're talking about the business I'm consulting for who do have physical products.
Great. Okay. So you consult for businesses at the high level. That's great. I mean, that's really, broadly speaking, the reason we've got you on, because I think that there is a need for thinking outside of the box sometimes. I mean, sometimes you need the nitty gritty of Amazon's latest terms of service changes and exactly how to rank on that platform, for example. But I do think that the big picture strategy is often where people go wrong. I mean, very simply, sometimes people come to me with their businesses, it's non-Amazon problem. It's their finances are a mess and they don't even know whether they're making a profit or loss. And I'll send them off to a really good accountant. Now, they need to have a specific skill set. But yeah, I'm with you on the big picture strategy being valuable. So let's flip onto the topic of traffic then, because that's obviously a big topic for any internet marketer. People who sell on Amazon primarily can get lazy about that because Amazon's, I mean, say lazy, you have to work incredibly hard, but Amazon provides the traffic. You've got to fight for a share of it. But as 2020 dawns, I think that getting traffic off Amazon, whether you sell on Amazon or on Shopify or wherever else, is a huge part of the picture. So let's talk traffic strategies. First of all, I know you've got a neat sort of little encapsulation of your principles for high defined traffic. So let's talk high level first. What do we need to be thinking about when we're evaluating a traffic source or a channel or indeed any way of getting traffic?
Absolutely. So there's obviously a lot of traffic sources. Like every single month, there are new ones coming out. Like, for example, MiniChat was the top 2019 one. I don't hear much about MiniChat nowadays. Of course, there's SMS going back to direct mail. There's like so many ones hitting at you. But when I think about traffic sources, instead of thinking about it from the lens of this is a shiny new object, I always think about it from first principles. And when I think about it, it's almost like in my mind, I'm doing a 2x2 matrix. So if you can imagine like an x-axis, y-axis, so thinking you guys back to your geometry days there and the algebra days, is I always think about, first off, is how relevant is this traffic source to your audience. Like, for example, I could be selling our company does right now is we help people become management consultants. So very simple, people want to be management consultants, very simple mission statement there. But for example, you're not going to be able to find my audience in, let's say they're not on Twitter or Instagram talking about they want to be a management consultant. But when you think about other resources like conferences or Reddit or Quora, they are having those conversations and those dialogues there. So I think about what is relevant to the audience. The second thing I always think about is what's the potential ROI. So for example, something could be like very profitable and very lucrative, but at the same time, if there's so many competitors on it that I'm barely making any money, there's not room for error. So I almost like to figure out where is there a resource that's very relevant to my audience, but there are very few competitors. People aren't using the platform. As a result, there's a larger room for error, if you will. So you don't have to, for example, get everything perfect in order to utilize the platform.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think one of the things about Amazon is that people get very confused because it does so many things at the same time very well in some ways, that it's a traffic source, it's a selling and conversion mechanism that converts it in some cases 30-40%, which is just unheard of for anything outside of Amazon, really. And then, of course, they do fulfillment very, very well as well. I mean, better than the post office, if you ever try and do it, particularly the British post office seems to have quite a good habit of losing parcels. So, yeah, I think one of the things that attracted people to Amazon, and that was back in the day when I joined, is that there was indeed that gap between a relevant audience, although most people got a bit sort of agnostic about what the hell they existed for and just wanted to make money. So that's an interesting question, actually. But the shiny object thing was, I guess, genuinely shiny in that there was a gap between the demand and the supply, because there was a massive spike in traffic and people, you know, eyeballs, if you like, in 2013. And by 2014, there was a sort of undersupply, which is now not the case. But I think what you're pointing out is that those opportunities come up and exist all the time. and go through waves. And I think one of the ways that as Amazon sellers, just to tie in what we're doing with Amazon, that we can leverage this is really simple, which is get traffic wherever it's, you can get the relevant audience and the low competition right now, and then drive it back to Amazon because they're still good at conversions, right? So just to bring it home for Amazon sellers listening, do not assume that just because we're not saying Amazon every 2 seconds that this isn't relevant. In my experience, it entirely is. And I think this is the big play for 2020. So just to make sure that people keep listening. So let's come back into, give an example. I know we talked about an example of selling podia or podiums, depending on how Latinate your English is earlier. So tell me about that example. You were talking about selling podia as an example of how this might work.
Yeah, absolutely. So for context, anyway, Michael gave me a challenge. All right, David, even though you're not doing Amazon, imagine you have to sell a podium, like a speaking podium. Then I would think, where would I go? Well, the first thing I would think about is instead of thinking Facebook, Amazon, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, or whatever, I always think about, well, who uses podiums? And a lot of times it is speaking events, conferences, and so forth. And I think, where can I find these people? Not just online, but offline. Where can I find them? And one of the ideas I came up for is Toastmasters International, which is a public speaking organization with over 300,000 members all around the world. And every single time you go to a club, there is a podium and they're always forming new clubs. And of course, the people there also have speaking events as well. So I would almost think about sponsoring these clubs and these events with my podium. Or even in fact, if it's a really good podium, going to some of their conferences and actually giving them away for free and just being able to promote it there. Because I always think about where can you get the most exposure for the least amount of effort and time spent.
Yeah, that's totally music to my ears. Absolutely. Best exposure for least time spent. And I was just thinking in terms of e-commerce examples, I used to sell some music products. I at some point had a dabble with music stands, which is a bit too generic, and I sold music stand lights at some point for ages. And actually, that's the sort of thing that if I went to, for example, I was a French horn player professionally in my past life. And if I went to a horn conference, there'd be a bunch of people selling things like French horn stands, you know, sort of put it down to rest. If you've got a very long rest in a long opera or something, music stands, you know, French horn specific stuff. So that's the sort of thing you could definitely be buying on Amazon as well. But they would sponsor conferences. They would give away some freebies and stuff. They would interact with people in person. I think that we forget, we get very obsessed with the idea of we are e-commerce sellers and we put ourselves in a box. And let us not forget that Amazon, the greatest and biggest by far of all e-commerce companies, quotes unquote, is actually developing physical stores. And there's got to be a reason for that, right? So I love that broad-mindedness that you have, because I think people very easily dismiss offline stuff. Okay, let's come back to this question of the audience then. So obviously finding relevant channels for the audience implies that we understand the audience or the buyers. And I think, again, on Amazon, because it's very non, we get very little demographic information. Everyone gets very keyword centered if they're intelligent, or very product centered if they've really lost perspective. So tell me about how do we figure out about our audience, or what do we need to know about our audience slash our potential buyers?
Yeah, so I guess in the coaching world, it's a little easier. I can just email, phone call, and so forth. And of course, on Amazon, you can get like the mailing addresses and so forth. So it's like a lot of ways to be able to, but you can't just call them up, or at least now you can't with the new terms of services for many years now. So if I was doing a physical product, and some of the people I do work with do physical products and they're launching for the first time, they're not asking me for like tactical logistics. They're like, Dave, just help me with the strategy here. And one of the things that we always do first is we literally look at reviews. So if you're an existing business with a lot of reviews, I can pretty much go through and read the reviews and kind of figure out who your demographic audience is. So without saying the product, because I know he's probably not going to be appreciative if I share the product here. One of the people I recently helped with a physical product, he was trying to figure out where to market his product, ideally offline, except he couldn't figure out who his demographic was. He had the shipping address, kind of had the names and things like that. So what we did was I said, hey, let's just spend an hour going through your reviews. And then I'm reading all the reviews. I'm like, hey, I think these are parents and I think they're buying it for their PTA clubs. And he's like, there's no way they're buying this product for a PTA club. I was like, look, like literally just do a search right here, PTA, Amazon review. And I was like, hey, let's check your competitors' products too. Same thing, PTAs. And guess what he's doing now? He's making a list of all the PTAs that he can potentially sponsor their events and so forth. So I always find that the first thing that's really great is to be able to look at the reviews that people are leaving you and thinking about how they found you. And for me, one of the things is, of course, this is like old school, but I always think about how, what can I do? Like in my business, I give a phone call, but sometimes I actually, if they can't, I will mail them and literally say, hey, how's this everything? Here's my phone number. Keep me in contact. But also like your raving fans, if someone's literally willing to read a postcard from you and call you back, you bet they're going to be buying your products and trying to figure out who they are. Cause you, I think people have this perceived notion of who their audience is. But once you actually start the business, you start to quickly realize who your audience is and who isn't. Like, for example, even in our coaching business, when I first started, I thought, oh, we're definitely going to help the Harvards, the Yales, the Oxfords, the Cambridges, those types of students. But the more we do have the Harvards and Yales. But then all of a sudden, we get all these other schools I haven't thought about. That's like, oh, they actually have a gap in resources for being a management consultant. Oh, we probably should partner with these schools. And now we have some of these school partnerships as a result. But it wasn't something that I thought about day one until I really looked at the information that was available.
The first thing I'm getting is keep it simple if you can be simple. I mean, there's nothing wrong with going to PTA or, you know, Toastmasters Association or whatever, and forming associations with, I guess, organizations, but not necessarily international mega organizations. PTA, by the way, is a parent teacher association in the States, right? Same as in the UK? Okay,
yeah,
just double checking. There's an abbreviation that's actually the same. So one thing that strikes me about this, and this is an important thing to touch on, I think, is that these don't sound like very sort of big scale things. For example, if I start running Facebook ads, which was really a favorite thing for launching, again, people talking about it less these days, although I know people still using it. That feels very, very scalable, very big scale. You can get thousands of people seeing your adverts, or tens of thousands, or even a million. The Parent Teacher Association sounds very sort of humble and low scale. Tell me about your thoughts about that.
So two things. I actually think they're probably bigger scale than you want. So if you look at the PTA numbers and the Toastmasters numbers, the audience reach is quite big. So for example, sponsoring one Toastmasters international conference, if I was doing podiums, if you told me I could reach 300,000 people who are in my target audience, I'm pretty sure no one on Amazon or anywhere else would be like, yeah, I want 300,000 people looking at it. The same idea is that in the beginning, I always think about the Paul Graham, who wrote to say, do things that don't scale. Because in the beginning, you are trying to figure out what are these marketing channels that you need to go to grow. And for me, having those one-on-one connections to begin with, you're not always going to do it. But that's how you discover what works and what doesn't work. I think almost people are allergic to hard work almost. And they're thinking about, like, I just want the quick fix solution. I just want to put on some Facebook ads and call it a day. But I find like the greatest success for us, besides like working on our product and making sure that we actually get the results, is when you think about the marketing of it, is figuring out where did we all start off really small. Like for example, in the beginning, when right now, one of my favorite channels is Reddit, where we currently use a lot of our resources. In the beginning, it was just me posting comments on Reddit. So Reddit, for anyone who's unfamiliar, is think of it as a forum similar to Yahoo Answers or so forth, except they're sub-communities. And so I was on the consulting sub-community just answering questions when I first started. And of course, this doesn't scale. Me getting on Reddit for 2 hours isn't good, but it's like I proved that Quora works. So now if I sponsor the subreddit or use the ads, I know it'll work versus just going out there and maybe I'll make a money, maybe I won't make my money back. But I think starting small is how you can scale it out that way. And that's how we've been able to find all these, call it marketing channels, that even people in our space are completely ignoring.
Yeah, that's really good. I mean, I love that. I mean, first of all, you're putting a size on things that if Toastmasters could reach 300,000 people, that's actually more than big enough audience. We get obsessed with size. And I guess that's falling into the same issue, which is, I suppose I'm always, let me try and put this again. Let's edit that rubbish out and start again. So the first thing that strikes me is that the fallacy of size of market versus market share there. But just because Facebook has, you know, probably getting on for a third of the planet on it doesn't mean that you're going to reach a third of the planet, because there's other people advertising it as well. The same with Amazon. A lot of people come to me who are new to e-commerce selling, and they look at a market on Amazon. They say, look, there's $500,000 worth of this widget a month being sold. And I've worked with somebody, and they were worrying about the fact there's literally $10,000 a month of some widget being sold. And I said, look, never mind the size of the market. If you can capture 80% of that market, you're doing $8,000 a month with one product. That's quite respectable. But also you'll have profit because you'll actually be dominant. So that's the first thing is size of market does not equal size of your share of it, which is huge. But I love even more profound than that. I mean, most grown-up people will get that once they've been around for a while, but don't worry about scalability at all. Don't do things that don't scale. That's Paul Graham, right? You were saying that's the founder of Y Combinator. So for those who haven't come across, there's the most successful startup accelerator in the world, apparently. Can't remember who they've incubated, but lots of things. But I think you're absolutely right about the starting small, because because you find out detail and you get a sense of the texture of the market that you just can't do on a big scale, in my experience. I mean, I had one client a while ago just literally talking to five people with a particular physical disability on a Facebook forum. He just managed to get in touch with five people, and they really helped him to develop quite a unique product for that particular market, or rather tweak an existing product so that it was really geared to their needs. And it was a textbook vindication of my approach with him, because he did actually literally talk to just five people. But those five people, I think, helped him make that first iteration of the product. And then, of course, the market will give its feedback in the usual style on Amazon, like, I hate this, it's rubbish, in the usual positive Amazon review style. And then he'll have to iterate again. But I really think that's true. And I love that message. And I don't think there's enough of that out there. People make stuff very complicated because, as you said, they don't want to get their hands dirty. They want to press a button and some magic wizard does stuff for you. But the truth is, they are my experience. I mean, let's have a quick talk about, let's diss Facebook ads for 2 seconds. the truth is that some very clever people get really great results with launching things on Amazon through Facebook ads and sometimes discount codes often. But that's really hard in my experience. I don't know many people who do that. What's your sort of experience of more traditionally scalable type advertising in the early days of a startup?
Sure, absolutely. So prior to having our company, I worked at JumpCut, where I ran their Facebook ads as well as being involved in the YouTube ads. We spent like 7 figures on these ads. So we basically had the money, but we knew we were bringing back the ROI. So I will tell you that it works, but it works if you know what you're doing. So it's almost like, even though Facebook is the most popular, and for some people, Facebook could be the answer. As in, funny enough, I was consulting with a physical product some years ago, a casket company, and they sold caskets on Facebook and we made it work. And so the audience is definitely there and the audience is there. But it really comes down to a fundamental question is that like the best use of your time? Like, for example, if you're selling a product that could easily be sold on another platform, why spend more time on Facebook if the answer is YouTube? So for me, it's just because everyone else is doing it does not mean that that's the best way for you to scale it out. Using your example, Michael, of the market share, it's like, yes, it's a big market size, but if your share is like 0.001%, like by logic, if you feel like you want to go after your next one, you should probably start a search engine. But chances are that's not going to be where you get your market share from.
Just start a search engine. Yeah, there's a certain brutal logic. It's like, yeah, I mean, the reality is, I think, in my experience, the best way I can put it is just to encapsulate it is Shark Tank or Dragon's Den. When people come on and they say something like, I don't know, for example, staplers is probably $1 billion a year market. And they say something like that. And immediately the dragon slash sharks just throw their hands up and go, get out of here, because this person doesn't actually have any percentage of those sales. So I think that tells you everything you need to know. Nobody's going to take you seriously just because the market's big. So, yeah, and I love what you're saying. Yeah, so you guys obviously very seriously good at Facebook ads, but it comes down to, is it relevant? And don't be swayed by the fact that everyone else is doing it, which I guess we've knocked that one on the head. So look, let's say you're selling a few hundred dollars worth of products on Amazon, and you know, you've got started with the product, but you want to reach the customers to understand them better, to be able to know, for example, what channels to market to them off Amazon. How do we get to the customers? How do we sort of figure that out? Because one of the things Amazon is very bad at is sharing any information, whatever, but especially any sort of demographic type information. So what are your sort of workarounds for that?
So again, I love reading your reviews. So I'll tell you an example. So we were talking about this over the holidays, but I think I mentioned I basically was building a gym in my garage. And one of the things that I realized was that I needed padding for the weights. And so I went on and I just found that the best material for the size was actually a oversized yoga mat. And so I decided to buy the yoga mat instead. So I'm not using it for yoga, but literally for a gym. And it's funny enough, when I was reading the reviews, I was searching for it, and other people were either one, using it for a gym, or two, better yet, they were using it to soften the play area for their kids. So call it a playpen. And I'm wondering if the person who is selling it knows that their product could also be used for someone who's trying to build an in-home gym, which is a large market, or second, just someone who's trying to protect their kids from falling over. And I think those are the things that, even though Amazon restricts you on the information you get, you just have to get a little clever. And like I said, I always like to work harder than the next person, or smarter at least. And I doubt that anyone who has like a lot of reviews or knows competitors who have hundreds of reviews are actually reading it. Because if I was selling an Amazon product, I would just read through every single review, especially those. The difference, I would think the 4 stars and the 3 stars are probably where it's at. It's like one where I can make my product better. But the 5-star review is like, oh, I love it. Except I'm using it for a completely different reason than what you thought it was. And then that, of course, launches an entire market. And you're like, okay, so if parents are using this for their kids, where can I market to parents? And then, of course, that's where the engine for Facebook, for YouTube, and so forth kicks in.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So in a way, what you're trying to do is just look at the use case, I suppose. It's not so much a demographic question as a usage question, which is slightly different again, right? And you're right. That's another exercise I was going through with another client the other day, is that we were looking at a particular kind of engineering type product. It's so painful not being able to just talk about products on Amazon, but everyone's so paranoid about giving away keywords. So I respect my client. But anyway, he was looking for a particular type of product, and we were just looking. It was a very versatile product. You can use it in lots of different situations, a bit like a yoga mat. You know, it's just a piece of rubber. You can use it for anything. And we were just looking at what, you know, people are using on their motorbikes, and they were using it on cars, and they were using it on whatever other types of vehicles or devices. And again, that was quite easy to glean from looking at multiple reviews. It was harder to know whether this person was like a, you know, a boy racer, or somebody who uses their car for commuting, or somebody who smashes up at weekends. That was, you know, that kind of information, that context was harder to get on Amazon, I have to say. So coming back to the Amazon platform then, you give us some good ideas of use case. How about actually reaching out to customers? As you were saying in the end, there's no substitute for talking to people, and I think we've agreed on that. How would you get around that difficulty on Amazon? I mean, this is a bit of an unfair question because I know you're not an Amazon specialist, but how would you approach that from your sort of broader perspective?
Absolutely. Well, I hang out with enough people, and some of the people I do work with on a strategic level are Amazon. So I do know it's like information is like hard to come by. It's not like me where you just happen to have their phone number, you happen to have their email or things like that, unless you came in very, very early into the Amazon game. But I think one of the things that you do have is that shipping address. And I think that shipping address is so, so, so important. And because that's your contact point, which is that competitors are not doing the little things like sending out a postcard. So I might be the super minority in this one, but I will tell you, sometimes I purposely sometimes don't go for the ones that rank 1 or 2 on the product. For example, if I'm buying headphones, actually a couple of years ago, I was buying headphones. And I, instead of going for the 1 and 2, I decided, who's on page 2? And I was like, oh, some decent reviews. Okay, they don't look fake. They don't look like some for agency in China wrote these. So let me just buy it and see what happens. And I was very, very pleasantly surprised when I opened it. There was a personalized note card. As in, it could have been a service who did this as part of the shipping. But I got a personal card and it said, hey, we'd love to hear how you find these headphones. And then there was a number I could reach, and it was a real person. So I was like, hey, let me actually just email this person. And then they asked me about the product and so forth. And I want to say that that person, him or her, got so much information from me that day about why I decided to search on page 2, what did I like about the product, what I did not like. I basically wrote their sales description and updated it for me. And funny enough, before 3 weeks ago, I was shipping somebody else. I was like, oh, they're on the first page now. Holy crap, how many reviews do they have? So it was amazing to see the progression there. And when I look at the description, I was like, okay, I'm pretty sure other people said these same things, but like the reasons why I bought it and why I used the particular headset that I mentioned, it was all there. And it's like, not the product didn't change. It was just literally the description. So I was like, very well done. And of course, am I a minority who replied back? Probably. But it's like, there's so much touch point there that, again, the personalized handwritten card I still have in my house on my desk somewhere, it's probably a fake, or it could be a real, but either way, it caught my attention.
Absolutely. I think, again, this scalability question, I think a more profound point I'd like to make here is that if you put a card in your packaging or you send a separate postcard, it's going to be expensive, right? But I mean, first of all, I love getting things in the mail, as you call it, or the post, as we call it in Britain, because it's rare these days. I mean, it used to be that I got a lot of mail, and a lot of it was junk mail or, you know, trying to sell me stuff. Now, mostly it's not. The odd local pizza place tries, but it's a pretty empty channel. And you were talking about at the beginning of the episode, just to neatly wraps up, I guess, that go where the competition is low, and it is now low in your mailbox. But the other thing is the scalability question. If you ask say 1,000 people to phone in and 10 people do, that's not a failure, because those 10 people are really rabid fans. And actually, you only need 10 people to help you completely rewrite the listing. And that's just a beautiful example of how simple it can be, that you don't need that level of people. And I would go further and say, this is how the universe works, is 80-20 of the 80-20 of the 80-20. Those people probably make you half of your profits. You know, even, for example, drinking, I'm not suggesting anyone start selling alcohol on the basis of this, but the drinks industry, I mean, they say drink responsibly, but the statistics that I've read is that something like 20% of drinkers are making the vast majority of the profits, because they order like 50 beers a week as opposed to two, which isn't surprising when you think about it. But if you are a person who has 50, like my wife is like this with face care products, like if you've got sort of like 300 types of face care and skin cream, and I don't even know what it is, you probably, you know, really know your skin cream and you know exactly what you like. And if somebody can talk to you about it, you probably, you could support half their business. I mean, my wife seems to support half of L'Occitane, which is a very nice sort of French care brand. So anyway, some random thoughts on in response to that. And I really, really like that. I think if I had to sum up this episode, that what we're saying is forget about scalability and go where the customers are that you want to be after, and go where the competition isn't. Have you only got any further thoughts to sort of wrap this episode up? Because I know we've got an exciting episode coming up talking about Reddit and Quora. So if you want your actionable, simple hit of do this, then stay listening to the next episode. But for now, wrap this up in a bow for us. Where do we, what's your summary of this?
I think you did beautifully, Michael. Is I start with things that don't scale, because eventually you will figure out that one thing that scaled. And then, of course, in the next episode, we'll talk about how I ended up scaling our business up to basically $100,000 a month. And again, great product, but backed up in the beginning, we need some channels to reach people, and how we ended up going on Reddit and Quora as a result. And it started off really small.
Excellent. So stay tuned, folks, to the next episode to find out all about Reddit and Quora. And those are some serious numbers, so worth staying tuned for. Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.